What you have before you now are the texts of the Second Council of Nicaea, the Seventh Ecumenical Council, the decrees, the anathemas, the canons. We will look at the decrees first of all, and what one finds at the beginning is a restatement of what has gone before. And this is very typical of the later councils, a restatement particularly of the Niceno-Constantinopolitan Creed, and a restatement of the anathemas that the councils before this current one had affirmed. In other words, an affirmation of and a statement that one is in continuity with holy tradition. If you drop down to about the third paragraph, you'll see in a highlighted text that they are particularly concerned in this age and at this council with people who have failed to distinguish between the holy and the profane. They are concerned with those who have called the images of our Lord and his saints by the same name as statues of diabolical idols. So this is a council primarily concerned with the iconoclasts, with those who declare that the making of representational art of Christ, of the Blessed Mother, that these are sources of idolatry. If you drop then now past the recitation of the creed, the restatement of the traditional anathemas, and in a highlighted text, there's a little gold bar, and then the text itself is in a lighter color, a text that begins, "To make our confession short," we find here a statement that basically describes the developing spiritual tradition of Christian imagery. It is an early articulation of what will become a theology of beauty, a theology of representational art. And you can see that in the first paragraph, it particularly roots itself in, and this is following on the tradition particularly of John Damascene, that the incarnation of the Word of God is seen to be real and not merely fantastic. The Greek word there refers to appearance. The incarnation is real. God has become flesh, and the implication is therefore that we may depict the God who is chosen to become flesh. And so it goes on, as you drop down a little further, to state that the figure of the precious and life-giving cross, the venerable and holy images, may be set forth in painting and mosaic, as well as other fit materials. In the later tradition, there will be a particular emphasis in the East on two-dimensional art and a suspicion of statuary. That is not necessarily the case at this period, although there is some hint of a preference for, as you can see, paintings, mosaics, and other fit material. These are flat representations that it is describing, but it is certainly not excluding the possibility of three-dimensional representational art. And in particular, as you can see, there is enumerated in the text that follows pictures, images, representations of Jesus Christ, the Mother of God, the angels, the saints, and of all pious people. So there is no limit to the holy ones who can be depicted in imagery. And it goes on to assert, and here again it has John Damascene to thank for this formulation, the more frequently that they are seen in artistic representation, by so much more readily human beings are lifted up to the memory of their prototypes. From the image, one is lifted up to venerate, to honor, to imitate the prototype, that of which it is the image, and to a longing after them. So there is both a desire to remember and to long after, to a desire, especially union and relationship with God, and to these should be given due salutation and honorable reverence. Aspasmon kai time tekein proskunesin. So time, or honor, or reverence, and proskunesis, another term for honor, are the particular terms that are used to describe the honor that may be offered, the reverence that may be given to pictorial images. This is not, the statement goes on, the true worship of faith, latreia, which pertains alone to the divine nature. So here is a distinction between latreia and time, between honor or reverence on the one hand, which may be offered to images, and worship, which is given only to God, to the Trinity. And the earlier notion of honor, timē, may be offered to, and again it's reiterated, to the cross and the book of the book of the Gospels. And this seems to have been a source of concern, that the cross is acknowledged as a valid and useful image at this point. Again, we're well past the time when crucifixion would have been a form of public execution. The cross can become an image held in reverence and esteem, not one that's held in fear and even in disgust. And the book of the Gospels may also be offered honor and reverence, and may also be decorated with icons or images. And again, the statement towards the end again is that the honor paid to the image passes on to that which the image represents. And one who reveres the image reveres in it the subject that is represented. This is the theology of veneration of images. If we then drop down in this text, there is now an assertion that this is in accordance with the teachings of the Church, although, as we'll see, there is concern in this council to assert that it does not necessarily have to be a written tradition, that there may be unwritten traditions, a kind of an assertion of a development of doctrine which the Church has practiced and which continues to exercise, and therefore the fact that a thing may be determined to be of relatively recent origin does not necessarily mean that the practice cannot be employed. And there's a restatement, and the text is highlighted here as well, that the book of the Gospels, the cross, may be offered honor, as well as representational art and the relics of martyrs. And there is a particular rejection of those who turn to common use the sacred vessels or the monasteries. And this was something that had occurred especially during the era of persecution, during the era of iconoclasm, because it was particularly in the monasteries where the icons continued to be illicitly reverenced and even manufactured. So the monasteries were particular subjects of attack. Then if you look at the anathemas in regard to the images, those are condemned who do not believe that Christ can be represented in his humanity, which is effectively what one is doing. One is not attempting to depict the divinity, one is depicting the humanity which Christ himself chose. And number two, anathema are those who do not accept representation in art of evangelical scenes. It is permitted to depict biblical stories, to try to flesh out, as it were, the stories that are told in the scriptures. This apparently was an issue for some of the iconoclasts as well. These images may be saluted as standing for the Lord and his saints. And this would again imply the offering of incense, the burning of candles, prostrations, physical acts of reverence, and kissing offered to the icons. If anyone rejects any written or unwritten tradition of the Church, let him be anathema. So there is again an acknowledgement that this tradition of using images in this way does represent a later and even not biblically based tradition, but nonetheless it does not have to be taken from the absolutely fixed and written tradition. It can be a so-called unwritten tradition and therefore be equally valid. Of some interest, not in the area of the resolution of or even the nature of the iconoclastic controversy, are the canons. These give us some idea of the kinds of issues that were arising now in the 8th century and give us a kind of a little glimpse of the Church and of the areas which needed to be legislated about. Canon 1 mentions provides a basis for the following of canons or laws, and in Canon 2 there's a statement that bishops must be biblically trained. They have to be familiar with the Psalter, with the scriptures, and with the canons. They have to be capable of praying the liturgy of the hours, of preaching the scriptures, and of knowing church law. In Canon 3, there is an assertion that bishops should be chosen by bishops, effectively by synods, and not simply by the local rulers. This certainly represents a problem in the East and in the Western churches, where the local king or the emperor is often very influential in the choice of the bishop, and the king of a realm may feel that he has the right to determine which priests in his kingdom are going to be elevated to such an important position. This remains a source of controversy, but here already it's asserted that ecclesiastical function must be left to ecclesiastics. In Canon 4, bishops should be very careful about receiving gifts for anything that they do, and we'll see this asserted a little later on, especially in regard to ceremonies such as ordination or the consecration of virgins or the profession of monastic vows. This can give the impression of simony, of selling holy things. Then the notion of a stipend, of a gift that is offered, becomes part of the tradition, but it also becomes potentially a source of scandal if the bishop requires it, and therefore effectively prevents those who are poor or communities that are poor from being able to have those ceremonies and celebrations which are required, such as profession, the professing of monastic vows. Canon 5 expresses this a little more clearly, that ordinations may not be purchased, that you may not give any impression of selling the ordination of any cleric. Canon 6 concerns the necessity for having local synods and to have them relatively frequently. Canon 7 expressly states that there are to be relics in altars. This remains a tradition in the Western Church as well, and has been followed in the Roman Catholic Church right up until the present time, that there are to be relics of saints in altars. In Canon 8, there's a statement about the reception of people who were formerly Jews and how they can be received into the church. In Canon 9, iconoclastic propaganda or texts are to be turned over to the episcopal authority in Constantinople, and that they be locked away with other heretical books, that people not regard these or read them. In Canon 10, there's the assertion that clerics should be stable within their dioceses. They should not wander around or move from place to place. In Canon 11, a constant problem that remains an issue today in the churches, treasurers ought to be present in the churches and monasteries. There ought to be an economos, someone who is responsible for and competent in taking care of the financial arrangement of the diocese and of the monastery. In Canon 12, bishops and abbots are not on their own authority to alienate or to sell church property. In Canon 13, monasteries, and again remember this is following a period of persecution of monks, monasteries should not be made into secular buildings, into public houses, effectively into hotels or restaurants. In Canon 14, there is a description of the office of lector, how they are to be instituted. In Canon 15, that a cleric should only have one church for which he is responsible. The practice of receiving the income of two churches is becoming an issue and is legislated here. In Canon 16, there's an emphasis on the need for simplicity in the attire of clerics. Clerics should not dress in a way that implies that they're members of the aristocracy. In Canon 17, churches should not be begun unless there is a hope that they can be completed. The notion of half-finished churches is regarded as problematic. And then in Canon 18, women are not to be living in bishops' houses or in monasteries. The problem of women who assist with cooking or with cleaning often gives rise to scandal, and so that has to be dealt with. In Canon 19, there's a specific statement, as we had mentioned before, that gifts should not be required for the making of vows, either by clerics or monks or nuns. This is what would be regarded in the West later a form of simony, of selling sacred ceremonies. In Canon 20, there's a forbidding of double monasteries, monasteries that have both men and women in the same communities. And in Canon 21, monks should not wander from monastery to monastery without the consent of their hegumenos or abbot. And in Canon 22, there's a suggestion of decorum for the circumstances in which it is necessary for monks to eat with women, how that's to be conducted without scandal. So one can see that the canons are beginning to legislate for very practical, realistic issues, suggesting the importance of the interrelationship between monastery and local church, between bishop and diocese, and other issues that will become prominent in the West. The relationship with the secular authority is also arising and being dealt with both in the East and in the West in this council.